Hey there, it's Todd Zwillick in for Joshua Johnson. A message on our podcast this week. We messed up. We made a change to our web servers that we didn't expect to have any effect on our podcast, and clearly we were wrong, and it forced a bunch of episodes into NPR podcast feeds, resulting in downloads that you didn't ask for. It also made it hard or impossible for you to find and listen to your favorite NPR podcasts. We are truly sorry for this. We fixed the root cause of the problem shortly after we discovered it, but it's taking a while for that fix to make it into all of the podcast apps. If you unsubscribe from this show or any other NPR show, please take a minute and resubscribe. If you're still having problems, go to our website, npr.org/help. We are taking steps to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. Thanks for listening, and now on to the show. This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. It's possible that no single human has had more influence over our culture and how it developed than Leonardo da Vinci. He is perhaps the most famous polymath of our times. There are a few fields his ideas and observations haven't touched. We know him best for artwork like the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper, and for his drawing of the Vitruvian Man, which revolutionized the study of anatomy. But we're about to learn much more about Leonardo's impact. And it's fitting that we do it today, because today is the 500th anniversary of the Renaissance man's death. Joining me to discuss Leonardo da Vinci's life and legacy is teacher and biographer Walter Isaacson. He's a professor of history at the Tulane University, and the subjects of his acclaimed biographies include Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, Steve Jobs, and of course, Leonardo da Vinci. Walter Isaacson, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Leonardo da Vinci, of course, died in 1519, 500 years ago today. In 2019, countries all over the world are organizing celebrations to commemorate his life. Why do you think this 500th anniversary is so significant to so many people in so many places?
I think this day and age, we've learned the value of combining many disciplines. It used to be in the 20th century, there was a separation of art and science. But when you look at the biotech revolution, when you look at the technology revolution and the digital revolution, you see people bringing together the arts and the sciences, music and math. And that is exactly what Leonardo did. I saw that Bill Gates did a wonderful video that's being tweeted around today, because his whole idea of what the digital revolution is about comes down to understanding how we connect arts and sciences the way Leonardo did.
Well, we don't have time to talk about all of Leonardo's influence in all of his areas of studies, because that's why your book is so thick, I think, 600 pages. But can you give me a sense of the breadth and the depth of this man's work, just an idea of the size of the influence he's had on us?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll pick one example, which is, you know, he was self-taught as a kid because he was illegitimate, he was gay, he was left-handed, he was sort of a misfit, so he didn't get sent to the traditional schools. And so he loves looking at how water flows past rocks. And throughout his notebooks, you see that flow. But you see him do it with curls of air and then curls of hair, like with the Mona Lisa, and even trying to do a little bit of the math, Fibonacci's equations. And then he dissects the human heart, and he realizes that the heart valve opens and shuts not because of the pressure of the blood going up and down, but because of the way the blood swirls and centrifugal force brings the valve out. That ability to see patterns, I can give you dozens of such examples, but that ability to see patterns across nature is actually what makes the Mona Lisa smile. Her smile is an example of that, because it's a combination of optics, anatomy, and pure beauty of art.
And as you turn the pages of his notebooks or reproductions of his notebooks to look at his life's work in his own hand, it must be amazing for you as a researcher, and I know you spent so much time with his work, his mathematic work, his artwork, his studies, his drawings, to get a sense of how he viewed the world through his own eyes.
You know, one of the really glorious things about Leonardo da Vinci, and I base my book on it, and there's so many pictures of it in the book, is that he left us more than 7,200 pages of notebooks, daily doodles, to-do lists, like, you know, questions he wanted to answer, like, why is the sky blue, or what does the tongue of a woodpecker look like, as well as anatomy drawings and sketches for the Last Supper, all crammed together on these notebook pages. And one of the small lessons I took from Leonardo is take notes on paper. Paper's a wonderful technology. 500 years later, we can still use it. It's still flipped through it, unlike our tweets and Facebook posts and emails, which hopefully will be gone 500 years from now.
Some of us have deleted some of them already. Walter Isaacson, who was this man, Leonardo da Vinci? What was he like in life?
He was a very congenial, fun, friendly guy, had a lot of people around him. He was very comfortable with himself. He was gay in Florence in the 1470s and 1480s when there was a new spirit of tolerance. So he dressed in, you know, wonderful garb. He had a young companion. They threw dinners all the time. We can look at his notebooks and even see what they bought at the, because Leonardo writes down what they bought at the marketplace. But he was also obsessively observant and curious. He'd look at a bird taking off and figure out, do the wings flap up or do they flap down faster? And then he would use that to try to do props in the pageants and plays he was doing so that you'd see little birds that would fly. And then eventually he tries to build flying machines. All of that is reflected in his art. So I think if you had to give a bunch of adjectives, it would be obsessively curious, playfully observant, and very friendly. He's just the most likable guy.
You know, I love hearing this because one of the images of Leonardo, one of the only ones we're used to seeing, is sort of typical of the time, kind of a scowl on his face, or he's a very old man. And you see that image, and you don't get the true side of him that you describe, which is lots and lots of friends, lots of parties, gay and gregarious, having a great time, and also a brilliant, brilliant observer of the world.
You know, if you want to know what he really looks like, I think, and I try to prove this in my book, Vitruvian Man, that wonderful guy doing jumping jacks in the circle in the square, that iconic drawing, that's the beautiful curls of Leonardo's hair that we know. That's the square jaw. That's the intense stare. You know, that's the very physical, strong, athletic body that he had. And I am sure that that drawing, and so are many other scholars, is Leonardo saying, here I am, standing in the world, standing in our cosmos, saying, how do I fit in? It's a perfect work of anatomy with perfect, you know, measurements of all parts of the human body, but it's also a great piece of art, and most importantly, it's a spiritual statement of here we are fitting into this cosmos. Hmm.
Did Leonardo catch controversy in his time? And if so, how did he handle it?
There was some controversy, and he leaves Florence for a while to move to Milan, partly because the main controversy about Leonardo was he was such a perfectionist that he didn't finish a lot of his paintings. So as a 20-something painter in Florence, we have a beautiful half painting of St. Jerome in the wilderness. We have a wonderful Adoration of the Magi that's just been restored, but he never finished it. And I think after a while, the Medici family got sick of this perfectionist young genius, and he ends up going to Milan and writing a wonderful job application letter to the Duke of Milan that's 11 paragraphs long. The first 10 paragraphs are all about his engineering skills and ability to divert waters and build weapons and build great buildings. It's only in the 11th paragraph that he says, I can also paint as well as any person. And of course, the Duke of Milan says, fine, do the Last Supper on the rectory of my favorite church.
Walter Isaacson, Janet sent us this email with a question. Is there evidence that Leonardo could have been dyslexic? Is there?
I don't like trying to diagnose people from 500 years ago. There's not much evidence that he's dyslexic because he loved to read. He read very well. You have to remember that the year he was born, Gutenberg opens the first printing shop and starts selling books. And so this is a godsend for Leonardo because he had not gone to university. He was clearly had attention deficit issues. I'm not sure I want to diagnose it as exactly ADHD, but he jumped around, was hyper-focused, but then also once he had hyper-focused, he'd sometimes get distracted and move on to other things.
It sounds like Leonardo was the type of person who you would have really liked to have been around. Sometimes I ask biographers like that, that question. Do you like this person? Would you have liked to spend time with them?
Absolutely. I've never quite understood being a biographer who writes about somebody you don't want to spend time with because you're living with the dude. And the two people that are most that way are Benjamin Franklin and Leonardo da Vinci. They're both, and the two of my subjects, and they both are interested in everything from science to governance to poetry to music. And they're both very gregarious. Mm. They both throw really good dinner parties, as we can tell from their memos and journals.
There are celebrations all over the world on this 500th anniversary of the death of Leonardo da Vinci. Next up, we're going to get into some of the reasons Leonardo's life and work are still influencing us today. I'm speaking with Walter Isaacson, the biographer of Leonardo da Vinci and so many other influential people. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A. Stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Weight can be a thorny topic, but Life Kit is here to give you the facts.
The scale measures the gravitational pull of the Earth at a given moment in time. The scale doesn't measure health, happiness, success, effort, or self-worth.
Here at Life Kit, we're rethinking weight. Find it wherever you're listening or at npr.org/lifekit.
It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm speaking with Walter Isaacson, professor and biographer of Leonardo da Vinci on this 500th anniversary of Leonardo's death. Walter Isaacson, you mentioned Bill Gates, just one of the influential people today who claims direct influence from Leonardo. And Bill Gates has been sending around a video of a manuscript, a codex that he bought, Leonardo's original notes. I think, I want to say $30 million. Listen.
This codex is the only one that's not in a European museum. Leonardo da Vinci wrote all of his observations in these notebooks, and his ability to diagram things and just think things through was the best. 500 years later, we have the actual notebooks. He does mirror writing backwards. Because he was left-handed, like I am, if you write the normal way, then you are always smudging the ink. And so if you do it backwards, then you completely avoid that problem. So here you're just seeing the page exactly as it looked to Da Vinci.
Walter Isaacson, once we get past the jaw-dropping $30 million price tag that Bill Gates was able to pay for that codex, you really hear one person who values elliptical, open-minded thinking talk about the influence that another person who values that kind of thinking had on him.
Those notebooks are so wonderful. And the notebooks called the Codex Lester that Bill Gates has, he's been good enough to put on display. They're actually in Florence now on display because they show Leonardo connecting his science to all of his other curiosities. And so they're wonderful drawings, as says experiments. He's trying to figure out how do mountain streams form? Is it because of precipitation or is it because of springs that come up from the earth? All of these wonderful curiosities. And as you look at it, I've looked at it, you know, with Bill Gates and looked at it in museums, you just say, oh my goodness, you can just sense the hand of the master. In fact, Vitruvian Man was something like that on a notebook page. And I remember when I went to go see it in Venice, there's a protractor hole, you know, right where you see Leonardo did the compass to do the circle. So it's just fascinating. Mm.
Steve Jobs also counted Leonardo as one of his heroes.
Yeah, he was going to name a product after Leonardo because Steve Jobs, whenever he announced one of his great products, like the new Macintoshes in the late 1990s or the iPod, iPhone, iPad, the last slide he showed at those great sort of unveiling announcements he did was the intersection of the liberal arts and the technology, two streets. And he said, that's where we at Apple stand. And he said to me over and over again that Leonardo da Vinci was his inspiration for standing at that intersection of the arts and engineering.
Mm. Well, you also note in your book that the difficulty of this term that we're so tempted to use with Leonardo da Vinci. Well, he's just a genius. He must have been a genius. And you say it's problematic in part because he was so grounded and so relatable, despite being so incredible at all these different disciplines. Can you talk a little bit about Leonardo's relationship to that reductive idea of being a genius?
Well, first of all, let's say he was really a genius, but I think that idea minimizes him because it makes it seem like he was touched by lightning, by the gods or creators or whatever, and had some superhuman powers. And in some ways, there are people like that, like Einstein or Newton. There's no way you and I or any of our listeners are ever going to reproduce the thought processes of Einstein or Newton because they did have some really huge, amazing, you know, gifted genius. I think for Leonardo, though, we could all try to be more like him because he wasn't particularly good in math, but he learned to love it. He was not very well educated, but he learned to teach himself. And what he had was curiosity. What he had was a passionate ability to be observant. And I think those are things that we can train in ourselves. So when I say that we shouldn't minimize him by just saying he was a genius, what I mean is we shouldn't say, oh, we'll never understand it. It's some mystery. No, we can understand exactly how Leonardo created everything he did because we can watch his mind at work. And it wasn't some weird superhuman power. It was just the willful and playful curiosity of a wonderful human being.
And maybe if even I'm not a genius, and I'm not, I can still look at his example of being observant and being patient and seeing the connections between things and maybe open up my own views of the world.
You can do it, and I try to do it. I took, you know, the streetcar coming down here or whatever in New Orleans, and I watch how the light hits a shiny leaf and the little bit of luster. And I move my head the way Leonardo did, you know, when he's writing about it, to see how the luster changes. These are just tiny things we can do every minute of the day once we put our iPhones down and say, I'm going to be observant. And most importantly, we can encourage that in kids, whether you're talking about K-12 education or your own kids. You have to avoid saying, stop asking so many stupid questions. You want to encourage that natural curiosity, that fascination with the world that we all have during our wonder years as children, and it gets knocked out of us after a while. Leonardo da Vinci never let those wonder years get knocked out of him.
Well, somebody with so much influence as Leonardo da Vinci has inevitably inspired some myth-making. And there are lots of people in our society today whose first moment knowing about Leonardo da Vinci may have been Dan Brown's massively popular book, The Da Vinci Code. It contains a popular conspiracy theory, Walter, and I know you know this about that Last Supper painting, and it also appears in the film version of The Da Vinci Code. Listen.
Wait, please. You're saying the Holy Grail is a person? A woman?
And it turns out she makes an appearance. Right there.
But they're all men.
Are they? What about that figure on the right hand of our Lord, seated in the place of honor? Flowing red hair, folded feminine hands, hint of a bosom, no?
Incroyable.
Pas tout à fait. It's called scotoma. The mind sees what it chooses to see.
Who is she?
My dear, that's Mary Magdalene.
Walter Isaacson, it was a fun movie, and boy oh boy did Dan Brown sell a lot of books. But true or false, is Mary Magdalene depicted at all in The Last Supper?
No, it's false. But let me do say, I love Dan Brown's books. I find them wonderful reads. I enjoyed The Da Vinci Code. But we have so much evidence of exactly who the model was in that. And, of course, it's John, who in The Da Vinci Code, I think Dan Brown said that, has the professor say, that Leonardo didn't do many androgynous figures. No, Leonardo always painted his figures to be somewhat androgynous, sort of sexually ambiguous. But that's John in The Last Supper, even though it's a wonderful plot device in The Da Vinci Code.
How religious was Leonardo? Devotional painting was hot in the Renaissance. It's how you got funded, and it's what people painted about. Was Leonardo religious? And how did he view the intersection of faith and science?
Leonardo was not conventionally devotionally religious. We don't have much evidence until his deathbed of him caring much about, you know, religious practices or going to church. In fact, he uses science to challenge some of the teachings, say, of religion. For example, he looks at all the fossil layers in the valleys around Florence and takes wonderful notes about them in drawings, and says that these were built up over thousands and thousands of years, so the biblical account of the flood, of the deluge, is not correct. And so he's willing to use science to challenge conventional religious dogma. That said, he wasn't anti-religious, and he does many Madonnas and other devotional paintings. I think you see the beginning of the Renaissance, the beginning of the scientific method, where people aren't just looking to only religion to give truths. Leonardo is saying there's other ways to find truths.
It seems like his impact is inexhaustible. It's been reported that there are plans to DNA test a lock of his hair and compare it possibly to living descendants. It's 23andMe for Leonardo and his clan.
Yeah, I think that would be fun. He had no children, so they would be indirect descendants.
Cousins.
But it's... yes, it would be fun. You know, we're going into a new age of biotechnology, and Leonardo would have loved it because he loved medicine, anatomy, physiology. And what we have now with DNA is sort of the wonderful code that helps explain some of our traits. And I think Leonardo would understand, as a humanist, how we have to make these connections between what is encoded by our bodies, and to what extent we ourselves can determine who we want to be, what we want to believe. That's something Leonardo wrestled with his whole life, and that's what makes him relevant after his death.
Leonardo da Vinci died 500 years ago today. We're learning a lot more about him from Walter Isaacson, the former editor of Time magazine and former CEO of CNN. He's now a history professor at Tulane in New Orleans and a biographer of da Vinci. More ahead.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes life is exactly like the movies.
T-minus 30 seconds.
They said T-minus.
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy and sometimes about rocket ships.
Back now to our conversation on Leonardo da Vinci with biographer Walter Isaacson. You may also know his books about Steve Jobs and Benjamin Franklin. Well, the 500-year celebrations are on, Walter Isaacson. Aside from doing interviews with grateful audiences, are you taking part? What are you seeing as you look around the world, activities honoring Leonardo and his life that are the most interesting?
Oh, I think there's wonderful museum and other exhibitions in England. The great anatomy drawings are owned by Her Majesty the Queen. They're in the Royal Collection, but they're being shown in places all over England, so it would make a wonderful drive. Likewise, the Tegart Museum in the Netherlands has I've been there. It's an absolutely beautiful exhibition. The Louvre, of course, will do the ultimate exhibition, because they have the Mona Lisa as well as the St. Anne and many other great paintings. And then Bill Gates's notebook is, as we speak, in Florence. And then there's a wonderful one in Madrid coming up. So I think people could make, if they could, a great tour of trying to see some of these wonderful celebrations of the life of Leonardo da Vinci. Mm.
At the very least, don't let yourself be duped by thinking if you've seen the Mona Lisa and you've seen that mysterious smile that you've seen it all when it comes to Leonardo.
I think the mysterious smile of the Mona Lisa is to me the ultimate thing about him, because he's dissected the human face to do the nerves and muscles just right. But he also understands how emotions from inside a human affect the motions of the face and the eyes. So it's the first painting we have that's truly alive. And if you go see it, please try to avoid, when you get to the Louvre, you'll see everybody there, and they're all doing selfies. They're trying to take pictures of themselves with the Mona Lisa doing selfies. Don't do that. Put the phone away and look at the Mona Lisa and think, this is how Leonardo would have done it. He would have observed it very carefully and felt the thrill of being in the moment.
Well, Walter Isaacson, we've talked so much and we've only scratched the surface of Leonardo's contributions and the breadth of his ability and his observations. As his biographer in our society, have you let yourself think about what our culture would look like if Leonardo was never with us, if he had never been born?
Well, what Leonardo did was he helped spark this ability to connect all of our curiosities. And that helped spark the Renaissance. But as I said when we were talking about the fossil layers or whatever, it's the first nascent feelings, the birth of the scientific revolution, of testing things by experiment. Over and over in his notebooks, he says, let's do the experiment. And then he revises a theory he has based on an experiment. And then he sees the beauty of the science and the beauty of some of the engineering and does beautiful drawings, but that becomes part of his art. So I think we would have had a slower time getting to the modern age, which depends on scientific inquiry and an enlightened view of the connection of spirituality to science, to art, to the human soul.
And we have just a minute left, Walter Isaacson. I have to let you go, but I would love to know, when was the last time you stood either on the Ponte Vecchio in Florence or outside of the Accademia in the square in Florence, Leonardo's hometown, and thought about him strolling through on his way to go shopping with his partner or on his way to do a study?
That's an absolutely brilliant question. And I remember just a few months ago being in those narrow streets of Florence, exactly where he lived, and thinking, my goodness, these very stones, he trod over them, and then going to see the notebooks there and saying he put his hands on this parchment and this paper. It was just a thrill.
The life of Leonardo da Vinci, celebrated this year on this day, 500 years to the day since Leonardo's death. Walter Isaacson is the biographer of Leonardo da Vinci, in addition to other figures including Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, speaking to us from New Orleans. Walter Isaacson, thank you so much for joining us. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. What an interesting topic. I appreciate it.
And it's wonderful to have you as well. And so many ideas from Walter Isaacson for us to take advantage this year and use the anniversary of Leonardo da Vinci's death to maybe expand our own minds just a little bit. This conversation was produced by Stacia Brown and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about Stacia and Miranda and the rest of the great team here at 1A, visit the website, the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for being here and for listening to this conversation all about the contributions of Leonardo da Vinci. This is 1A.